From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm so glad you were with us all week long. It's going to be an exciting hour. Kelly McEnany in studio. If you're smart enough to be watching us on Fox Nation or you got the app, you click on watch and you just scroll over until you see Fox News Radio. But there's so many video elements to this now. It feels like a TV show and a radio show. And Kaylee, believe it or not, is not sick of me. And we've talked on television already. Kaylee, is that true or false? You are not sick of me.
That is true. Not sick of you.
You're
one of my favorites. So
really?
No. Yes, you are.
All right. Fantastic. Can we, hey, Eric, can we cut that now for a promo, if that's possible? Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Hallie Biden described the moment she found and then discarded the gun, which is at the heart of this case. On Thursday, she told the jury she discovered a revolver and ammunition, along with drug residue and drug paraphernalia, while searching her brother-in-law Hunter Biden's car on October 23rd, 2018.
Hunter's hijinks on full display as it becomes clear that the laptop was always real and Hunter's crack-loving, hedonistic, irresponsible behavior, including getting his brother's widow addicted to crack. What a treat this guy is. Prosecution should rest today. How's that case going? We'll ask Kaylee.
Number two.
But to enforce the Biden strategy, that is why they never have given Ukraine the advanced weapons system they want, because they feared Russian escalation. And also, when they did get the advanced weapons system, restricted the use of them.
Yep, there is problems with this relationship. U.S. relations with Ukraine beginning to fray as the White House can't seem to get them the weapons we have sent over and can't train pilots a year later.
Number one.
It is not the only poll that has showed Virginia within the margin of error, but it is the most recent and reputable one that we have. That's an astonishing number to see. And that a state like Virginia, if that gets into the real toss-up category, your math to 270 becomes a lot more complicated.
You would say that. And you know how hard it is for a CNN expert to say that on CNN? That's the case. 2024, polls are in, and it's good for the former president of the United States just 2 weeks from the first debate, as the current president does something new, sits down for an interview. We look at all sides of 2024. So let's go to that, Kaylee. First off, a battleground state. Do you believe that Virginia's in play? Do you believe New Hampshire's in play?
I do. I've believed Virginia's in play for a long time. If you followed polling over the last 4 months, there's a Roanoke poll showing a tied. The two credible scientific polls before that show Biden with a single-digit lead. So our Fox poll is not this, like, outlier. This has been the case. The one caveat I would add is ground game, is mail-in voting, something I would add as a caveat across the nation, because these are poll numbers, but you have to operationalize them into votes. But the energy behind Trump right now, it's like nothing I've ever seen. You pull Virginia off the map, that's big. Biden is on defense. It's not just win the Rust Belt, it's we're taking blue territory.
So different. Obviously, the pandemic hung over the last campaign, but you really think the momentum now is better than 2016, better than 2020, and you were on CNN in 2016, right?
Yes.
And better and now in 2024.
Without a doubt, because people have had a taste of success during the Trump presidency, and now they remember that success and want a whole glass of that success. So I think the energy is huge. If I had to call the race right now, today, just a gut feeling, I would say Trump wins. But at the end of the day, it's a contest between energy and that ground game. And today, I think the energy outweighs the ground game.
And the big, there's two things, the debate, and then there's the sentencing on July 11th. If he does well in the debate and the sentencing is probation, they'll have a lot of momentum going to the RNC. But both things could go bad because the expectations are so low for Biden. And this judge has not done anything for the Trump team.
No, nothing for the Trump team. And that's why I've heard legal commentators who, you know the judge, have observed, say, look, there's a chance this guy gives jail time. He, of course, not merited, but the judge has shown that he is on the side of the prosecution every step of the way. The one thing I would say, though, is it's been kind of a jump ball as to how this verdict would play out in public opinion. The early polling we have with Fox, with Quinnipiac, is that it's going in Trump's favor. If that's the case, and then on top of all of this, if people are recognizing the injustice, then you see something like Hunter possibly acquitted or a hung jury and Trump possibly sentenced to jail time or even probation. That's just going to weigh on that angst people are already feeling. And I believe it could actually help the former president politically, of course not in his personal life.
Right, because you don't want Hunter to be a sympathetic person who's convicted on clearly was a drug gun violation. I mean, this is the biggest layup ever. You just keep wondering why they didn't cut a deal ahead of time. And you're saying, but with a friendly jury who feels as though his past is the past, that would even boost Trump more.
It would. And what's, you know, I believe in courts of law in this country and in juries and in verdicts. But when it comes to someone like Hunter Biden or Donald Trump, they have perhaps like the highest name ID of anyone ever. And it's almost impossible for people to separate their political opinions. And just in the jurors that were brought in as prospective jurors, it was amazing to me how many said, I know Jill Biden. I worked with, you know, Hunter Biden's friend. You know, I'm doing, you know, scenarios here, but they were familial ties that were brought up over and over again. Many of those jurors dismissed, but it just goes to show how close the Biden family ties are to Delaware.
So we know the current president sat down with David Muir of ABC. They talked about the president, former president's conviction, immigration, and the debate that's coming up. Cut one.
We are 3 weeks from this debate. What do you think you need to accomplish on that debate stage?
Say what I think. Let him say what he thinks. The things he said are off the wall. I want to be a dictator on day one. I want to move in a direction where he talks about, you know, suspending the Constitution. All I have to do is hear what he says. Remind people what he says and what I believe, what he believes. He's about him. I'm about the country.
Are you ready for this debate?
Yes.
Your thoughts. And now, if I'm Trump and I'm watching this, what am I thinking when it comes to prep?
I'm wanting to think this guy's not ready for the debate. I mean, you watch that clip and you're like, he's not ready. However, I remind myself of State of the Union. I don't know what changed that night. I don't know if it was a Red Bull. I don't know. But we saw a different Joe Biden, one who has the capability of, when the moment's there, exceeding expectations. So I kind of fight my inner urge to say, he's not ready, I've got this, and try to lower expectations. If I were the Trump team, that is what I would be doing, saying, no, you know, he's going to be more difficult than what people realize. I'd have every person on my team out there saying that.
I would do that, too. But looking at the substance of it, let's just say that he's 70 or 60 years old and can do it. When he says he's going to suspend the Constitution, there was a controversy where the president said, didn't say I want to suspend the Constitution, but indicated it was definitely misinterpreted that. He's got to go back, look at exactly what he said. He's getting, that's where he's going to go for it. The other thing he said about he's going to be a dictator on day one, that was a, John Hannity asked him, they think you're going to be a dictator. He goes, yeah, day one, because I'm going to fix the wall. I'm going to undo everything they did on the wall. I'm going to focus on the border, close the border, and then I'm going to go back to. So now they're saying dictator on day one. So he has to go back and clarify that.
He does.
Those independents, people that aren't zoned in like we are, understand it.
He does. And I think what he can say is, look, I spent 4 years in the White House. This is not a theoretical exercise we're dealing with. During my 4 years, when crowds chanted lock her up, I didn't lock her up. I had an independent DOJ. I had Bill Barr. You know, I had Jeff Sessions. They appointed a special counsel. I respected norms for 4 years. You've seen what I can do. Bring me back. I can do it again. And then go on offense and challenge the way Biden hasn't respected norms. Look, I know Biden says he's totally independent of these prosecutions, but there is a New York Times article saying he wanted Merrick Garland to stop acting like a ponderous judge and to go take action on January 6th. So we know what Biden has said
privately. You want Trump to say that?
Yes, I want him to say that and say, I don't know what you've done or not done. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt that the DOJ has been independent, but I do know what you think as laid out in the pages of the New York Times. You can challenge him. You can go on offense. Colangelo, bring up Colangelo.
I would say this, and also, what was Alvin Bragg doing at the White House? Why was Nathan Wade meeting twice with White House counsel over in Athens, Georgia? Why, you know, what do you mean they have nothing? If they have nothing to do with it, you should be furious. Why are your people meeting on the side? What else anyone think? So he talked about the trial, and this is what he said. Cut to.
Stop undermining the rule of law. Stop undermining the institutions. That's what this whole effort is. All the MAGA Republicans are coming out saying this was a fix. This was a jury that this was a judge that set up to get Trump. There's no evidence of any of that. None. He's trying to undermine it. Look, he got a fair trial. The jury spoke like they speak in all cases, and it should be respected.
If I'm saying that, Kaylee, what would you say if he says that, respect the trial? Then they go, Mr. Trump, what's your answer to that? Mr. President, what's your answer to that?
That this was a case, according to the New York Times, according to Ellie Honig, who worked with Alvin Bragg, so not a friend of mine, this was a case that has never been brought before. Unprecedented in its nature. Never before has state election law been brought for a federal election. In law, we have things called precedent. We follow precedent. We try to make sure that similarly situated defendants are treated in like manner. Well, this wasn't the case, clearly, when this is unprecedented. So fight back against that. But this is challenging. I mean, Biden gave, and I'm not saying I agree with the answer, but he did give the right answer if you're someone advising a Democrat as to what to say in this moment. You have Kamala Harris out on the late night shows going, cheaters are going to get caught. She's playing the attack dog on the verdict. Biden is playing I'm above the fray, which is a smart place for him, and it will be challenging on the debate
stage. I would come back on the judge. I'd go, yeah, what do you mean? They're fine. Juan Merzan, who gave to your campaign Joe Biden, whose wife worked for Letitia James Joe Biden, whose daughter works for Adam Schiff and Dan Goldman, who helped get Michael Cohen to testify against me. I go, there's no way you could possibly look at that judge as fair arbiter. And why would I feel good about a jury of my peers at a place where I got 15% of the vote? Why would I do that? And I would turn it around and I'd go, by the way, Mr. President, what was I charged with? Yeah. What did I do wrong?
Yeah.
No, that's not it. What was I charged with? Because they didn't come up with it to the last day. You might feel good with that verdict. I would never feel good with anybody should feel good with that verdict. The other two is, since when is it un-American to be critical of a jury's decision? You're entitled to it. Be critical.
Absolutely.
Hey, did the OJ jurors get it right? Pretty sure they didn't.
Right.
Pretty sure that was a killer they let go.
Yeah, that's right.
Am I un-American?
Right. Would you be comfortable with Hunter having a judge that earmarked $35?
That's a better one. That's a better example.
Going after MAGA extremists and specifically earmarked it, I'm fairly certain, and under very specific language of making sure and stopping MAGA Republicans. The judge did. If the converse happened, would you be comfortable with that judge being the judge for your son? It's a good question to ask, but I like what you're doing with the questions, by the way. Biden, we know, is not the sharpest tack. You want to get him off kilter. You want to get him on shaky ground. Asking him questions and stopping and letting him answer and respectfully asking it again, that is a good tactic. So I think he should pursue that line of questioning.
All right, here's him, Joe Biden, talking about his greatest vulnerability, but he doesn't realize it. Cut three.
You bring up your opponent, Donald Trump. He has said of your executive action, he's pretending to finally do something about the border. But it's all about show. He says we have a debate coming up. Biden's executive order is weak and pathetic.
Is he describing himself? Weak and pathetic? Come on. Look, everybody knows what's happened. We had a deal. It was much broader than this, much better, much more accepted across the board. And he got on the phone and told the Republicans, don't support it. It will hurt me. It will help Biden.
Well, this is a Mack truck. We know this is coming. What's an answer?
I think you say you were never going to enforce this legislation. And President Biden, in my 4 years, I did this without legislation. You tore up day one, first 100 days, 84 executive actions, many of which I put in place. If you wouldn't have torn up my system, we would not be here. And then go straight to the data, the millions of people who have crossed the border. Compare and contrast what we had under Trump, what they have under Biden. The facts speak for themselves. Trump didn't have some grand bipartisan immigration reform. He did it with a pen.
Right. And the other thing that he did, I think, is underappreciated even by him, is he sent his Homeland Security Secretary and his Secretary of State to Central and South American countries and said, you're not getting any aid until you control your population. And then he went up to Mexico and said, you need to enforce your southern border, and we're going to have a Remain in Mexico program. And he helped work on the trade deal, redoing with the USMCA. Still, in Obrador, at the end, was the last world leader, I think, not to acknowledge the election result of Joe Biden winning. How does Trump handle this question? Did you win or lose the 2020 election?
Yeah, that's a tough one. What I would say he does is say, I believe if the rules would have been the same pre-COVID, I won the election. And he can go through secretaries of states that change mail-in balloting rules and abrogation, many people would argue, of state legislatures in Pennsylvania, in Michigan. If those laws would have been the same, I would have won the election. I do believe I won the election. I don't think it was fair. I don't think it's the way it works per the United States Constitution. Stay away from, more of the outlandish theories. Go straight to the facts. Go straight to constitutional law. Go straight to how the election should have been conducted and how it was changed post-COVID.
Yeah, great answer. Kaylee, he's going to want you back in the fray, I think, but you can't go. You're here. Don't move. We have a couple more minutes left. Is that okay?
Great.
Because we got to get ready for Outnumbered at noon. I know that. We'll take a short time out. When we come back, more with Kelly McEnany. I want to talk a little bit about the Hunter trial. She's a lawyer, too. We got to tap into all her skills. Don't miss a minute. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan, but you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you subscribe to the podcast, like, subscribe, and share.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is just classic textbook Soviet-Russian tradecraft at work.
This laptop that intelligence officials have warned is likely Russian disinformation.
Ongoing Russian disinformation effort.
It is so obviously a Russian operation.
We still think that the stories from the fall about your son Hunter were Russian disinformation as a fear campaign, like you said.
Yes. God love you, man.
Kayleigh McEnany with us now. Kayleigh, they suspended your account when you retweeted the New York Post story talking about the laptop, and now it's used as evidence against Hunter, and the FBI looked at it and said, not only is it real, but it has not been altered. This stuff is in the cloud, and it's on the actual laptop itself. Your reaction, this must be surreal to you.
It's incredible, and it's infuriating.
These people were lying.
Yes, they were lying, and as you mentioned, you know, it happened to me. I was press secretary at the time. I tweeted on my personal account. They banned it. Then New York Post banned it. One of the most circulated newspapers in the country banned from Twitter. It is inconceivable to me today that here we are, and there's this MacBook 13 wrapped in plastic that's carried across the courtroom and verified. It did affect the election. It absolutely did. We've seen that in polling. People might have voted differently had they known that the Hunter laptop was real. And you want to talk about election interference? You want to convict a guy 7 days ago? Part of that conviction was election interference, the second crime. No, don't talk to me about election interference when you have the laptop, when you have the Steele dossier, and the list goes on.
How about the fact that our director of national intelligence, John Ratcliffe, said it wasn't Russian disinformation. It was real. And he got ignored. In exchange for Anthony Blinken working with Mike Morrell, guys out of the fray, out of government, to get 50 people, retired CIA, FBI, to weigh in and say it's classic Russian disinformation from Leon Panetta on down. So when you say if Trump gets in, he's going to have retribution, he was in. And they were still having more power in many cases over him.
Yeah, 51 intelligence officers arranged by Antony Blinken, who's now Secretary of State. And it was incredible to me to see on another network, Andy McCabe out there saying, I talked to people in the intel community and they're scared and we're wondering if we should leave the country. Well, why are you worried? What are you worried about? Trump has said over and over again, I'm not interested in retribution. Is there something you're hiding? Is there something we should know? I don't know why they're scared.
Kayleigh, we should not be scared to watch out number. Is that correct?
No, at noon. Watch us.
Right. And what else are you doing today? Is that it?
That's it. Going
to
a pool
after?
Party. Yes, with
all
my
right.
kids. There
all
you
right,
go.
That will not be televised.
No, you can televise that.
All
that's
right,
fine.
Good. I don't think we should. Brian Kilmeade Show, when we come back, we find out about the number one show in America and why the host is leaving and so much more. You listen to Brian Kilmeade Show.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, welcome back, everybody. 1-866-408-7669. A lot to discuss. I know the Hunter Biden trial is back in session now, and I played some of the laptop situations. Why did I play it? The reason why I played the laptop and all these people saying that it's classic Russian disinformation, of course it is because it's the center of this trial. And how ironic it is that the FBI, and I haven't gotten a good explanation from it. Just remember this. When people say that Donald Trump's paranoid and the system's not against him, here's a counter to that. So this laptop gets dropped off at this repair shop by a drug-addled Hunter Biden. And it literally has all the family secrets, the international business deals, his crack use, his addiction to sex, his prostitution, his calls to prostitutes, drug dealings, text messages. Just couldn't be worse. Could not be worse. So when it comes out it's so damning. And guess who publishes it? The New York Post. And then they sideline the whole story. And I mentioned to you that immediately everybody hops on these other networks saying classic Russian disinformation. They're trying to do in 2020 what they did in 2016, which, by the way, proved to be almost nothing. $1 million of Facebook ads was not deciding this election. So then we learned that the FBI had this laptop for a year and didn't do anything with it and treated the guy who gave it to them as really an enemy to the point they were trying to intimidate him and his dad. And he had laid off some of the information before he did it to make sure that this was not buried by a pro-Biden FBI. And it was buried. And when it came out, they denied that it was even his. And it played a huge role in the debate. That's why it matters. You know, I was talking to Kaylee off camera, who's a lawyer, and she said, you know, do you notice with this trial, even though they have a shot of Hunter Biden's got an eyewitness of him checking a box that he's not using drugs, and they know they have video of him buying the gun, and they have video of Haley Biden throwing the gun out into a dumpster, and all the story lines up. It looks like he's dead to rights. There's a sense that he's getting off. And here's why he's getting off. Because of the jury. The judge is running a tight ship, and the jury, even though you can get to throw out a certain amount of jurors, if you're the government, seems very pro-Biden. When he talks about himself as a sympathetic figure, they see the first lady sitting in the first or second row, and they evidently, some of the jurors were crying as they recounted his days addicted to crack and Haley Biden getting addicted to crack. To me, you indict him because of that. Not only do you have a drug problem, but you got your brother's widow addicted to drugs. So here, President Biden was asked, should he be convicted? What are you going to do before you leave or while you're still in office? Cut 28.
As we sit here in Normandy, your son Hunter is on trial. And I know that you cannot speak about an ongoing federal prosecution. But let me ask you, will you accept the jury's outcome, their verdict, no matter what it is?
Yes.
And have you ruled out a pardon for your son?
Yes.
I don't know if you give him a pass on this, but he's repeatedly said, my son's done nothing wrong. Really? The laptop's not real. Russian disinformation, you know that was a lie. You know you said it during the debate, and it changed the debate and changed the outcome of an election to a degree. And now you say, knowing that the laptop was real, all the crack and everything that's so obviously he's on, and now you say, my son has done nothing wrong. People are going to say, well, he's just a father protecting his son. Well, not really. There's one you could say he was an addict and did some things that are very regretful, but he's a new guy now. That's a more responsible thing to say. So prosecutors pulled out the actual gun yesterday that Hunter purchased and brought it to the witness stand. People could see how dangerous it was. They also had the laptop in theater. They showed some of the pictures. Even the sketch artist, I feel bad for the sketch artist, has to sketch some of the naked shots. They're all out there. Now the prosecution could rest today, and then we'll see about the defense. Abby Lowe's getting paid a ton of money. I think it's better for Trump if he gets off. Hunter Biden in jail doesn't help anybody. I'm serious. Nobody cares about Hunter Biden. They just want to know why he was leading the family on these international business deals. And that'll be uncovered, I believe, in the tax trial in Los Angeles. That'll be taking place, I imagine, soon. I'm not sure if that'll play a role in the election, but that's what I'm more interested in. The bank records, the millions of dollars, where it is now. Who got it? Who was bought? And we'll see where it goes from here. The other major story that we've been going over so far is what's happened to Ukraine. You know me. I like talking about this. I want Ukraine to be successful. I want them to repel the Russians, who, according to the President of the United States, have lost 350,000 people. 350,000. Now, for us, it would be devastating. You're talking world war numbers. I mean, we had two wars going at the same time over the course of 20 years. We didn't get close to 100,000. They were wounded in the 50s, though we sadly lost thousands. A lot of it was green on blue. Having said that, this is what's so frustrating to me. We have given the $65 billion to the U.S. government to give to Ukraine in munitions, and they're getting there extremely slow. And Zelensky, according to NBC, Zelensky and Biden have the this is the most fracturous time between the two leaders and the two countries, because he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, limiting what they can do with the weapons that they get, saying that even though Moscow is attacking from Moscow in these areas, you're not allowed to hit there. Who ever heard of trying to winning the war and not trying to take out the weapons facilities that are actually shooting the bullets at you? So that is a problem. General Jack Keane joined me earlier today, and he told me, you know, he does the Institute of Study of War. So not only does he know war, he actually knows what's happening in the war. Cut 24.
The underlying reason for it is there are different objectives. The Biden administration doesn't publicly state the objective that they're really enforcing, and that is they have from the outset wanted Ukraine to go to a negotiated settlement as soon as possible to end hostilities. And Zelensky's objective is clearly to retake all of the territory that Russia is occupying and drive those forces out of there. But to enforce the Biden strategy, that is why they never have given Ukraine the advanced weapons system they want, because they feared Russian escalation. And also, when they did get the advanced weapons system, restricted the use of them inside Russia in terms of long-range missiles, for the very same reason, not to aggravate Russia and force their escalation.
It's just so frustrating because these guys know how to win a war. They know how to implement the things that need to be done, but they're never allowed to by politicians that worry about a greater war. Listen, NATO is sitting right there, never been stronger on paper, got to press. All these nations spend their 2%. You got to lean on these nations to stop violating the sanctions on Russia, from China to Iran to North Korea. Use any leverage possible to do it. Instead, you have a president, according to the Wall Street Journal, who during the key Ukrainian meetings is totally detached, doesn't seem to be able to follow it, has nothing to it. Instead of a leader, you have a hindrance. And I worry we're going some 25-year-old from the State Department. It's that person's strategy. Meanwhile, he went to Zelensky and played politics. Cut 20.
We're not going to walk away from you. I apologize for the those weeks of not knowing what's going to happen in terms of funding, because we had trouble getting the bill that we had to pass that had the money in it from some of our very conservative members who were holding it up. But we got it done finally.
The bigger story is, where's the money from a month ago when it passed, or 2 months ago when it passed? Now, he's not wrong. It was conservatives in the House and Senate that said nothing's passing until you enforce the border. Then they go into the bipartisan border talks. They came out with a plan that they could not sign off on, and we're back to ground zero. But he's not wrong on that. But he hasn't. This is what people like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, and Michael Waltz, all who think it's extremely important for Ukraine to be successful. They want to see the plan. The objectives have to be explained to the American people. The progress has got to be monitored and relayed. Instead, they just want to bury the story, ask for aid, bury the story, ask for aid. Well, these Republicans got to get elected too, and people in their towns, in their districts are saying, I got some questions about our money going over there, and the tensions are real. Where are the F-15s? Where are the F-16 pilots? We're supposed to be training them for a year. What is the problem? We wouldn't give them planes, so other people who bought our planes of our allies said, we'll give you the F-16s. You just train them, and we have been unable to train them. That's the problem. Now, they're asking for the right to bomb Russia in Russia. Here's how Joe Biden described the limitations. Cut 21.
They're authorized to be used in proximity to the border. We're not authorizing strikes 200 miles into Russia. We're not authorizing strikes on Moscow, on the Kremlin.
Why? I mean, I don't necessarily want them bombing the Capitol, but they invaded the Ukrainians. They're bombing everything possible. They're taking out their infrastructure, aiming for kidnapping children, trying to blow up people in their homes. They're not going for people in their uniform, but we have to show a decorum, and we have to put limitations on the Ukrainians who know how to fight and know the stakes. Cut 22.
It theoretically could, but it's not likely. Look, the idea that Russia, this juggernaut that is absolute nuclear weapons, this conventional juggernaut, you know how many troops they've lost so far? 350,000 dead or wounded without a single American troop being engaged by supplying the Ukrainians with the weapons they need.
Well, their cautious way of approaching this is just all wrong. And the other thing you do is do what the Ronald Reagan did with the Pope and with Poland, Lech Walesa. They helped author the overthrow of the Iron Curtain by working with different passages below the radar in order to empower the working class to get rid of communism. There was all this stuff going on. But he plays his cards right out front and says they're not allowed to attack. And if they attack, we will show, we'll rebuke them in the press. It's just why people feel uncomfortable on him and his foreign policy. It's not a strong suit. I'm going to go over the polls when we come back and tell you what happened on the Fox News poll, what's happening in the battleground states, why Virginia is in play. And when it comes to foreign policy, what he said he has superior over Trump, he's trailing by double figures. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Ladies and gentlemen, here are the stars of our show, Pat Sajak and Vanna White.
Well, the time has come to say goodbye. It's been an incredible privilege to be invited into millions of homes, night after night, year after year.
Oh, that was it? I felt like he was mid-sentence. I thought he was trying to start to well up. I thought for a second maybe he got choked up, but that's it. I mean, what you do is you do 10 in a day or something. You work 2 days a week or 4 days a month. He made $15 million minimum a year over the course of what? How many years? 20 years? 30 years?
I think it was 41.
Of 41 years. And it was the number one show along with Jeopardy. It was one or two in syndicated television for the longest time. I think he was bored. When he was here, I think I told you this, he was here for about a year doing a show on Saturdays, Pat Sajak.
I don't remember.
And
that.
He's a big fan of Fox. At least he was. You're talking about a long time ago. And one thing I said to him, I said, you're going to keep doing your show? He said, yeah. I asked for an extraordinary amount of money, obscene amount of money, and they did it. He goes, I was hoping they would walk away because I think he was bored with it. And you see some signs during the time where you have these blow-ups. Just get fed up with people. But did you see Vanna White? Vanna White had a lot of nice things to say. Evidently, great friends, had countless lunches together. That's pretty amazing to be friends with someone for 40 years, work with them, you know, I guess often every month. I don't know their schedule, but it gets, I guess, intense sometimes. So she's going to stick around for a little while. But I have news for you. Ryan Seacrest is probably going to be better.
Well, he might be a little younger and livelier, but I feel like Ryan Seacrest also takes on something for a year or two and then gets bored with it too and moves on. So
you're talking about Kathy Lee?
No. Well, yeah, I mean, there he did that with Kelly Ripa. I feel like he's the big name to come in. It's exciting. But after like, what, 2 to 4 years, he's like, I'm done with this. But I mean, it's also lovely that, you know, Vanna White and Pat Sajak had this 41 year relationship. We always love to jump on like, you know, the animosity, the tension, but we don't really highlight when they just have a great friendship.
Should we also emphasize that the letters could probably turn themselves?
But then we don't get to see Vanna in her beautiful gowns.
Right. But aren't we supposed to, as a society, go with progress?
I mean, with AI now, I mean, do you even need contestants to guess the
Well, you need
phrase?
Contestants. That's the only thing discriminant. All right. So the other big thing is Caitlin Clark. So Gino Auriemma waited on Caitlin Clark, and you know what she's doing in the WNBA. And he said, look, the reason why she's not dominating, she was set up to fail. She's not big and strong enough. She's never supposed to dominate at that level. She's going to have trouble. That would be bad. If she cannot play like as at least an all-star, that would be a problem. Now, when asked about the physicality, Nancy Lieberman, arguably the best women's basketball player ever, weighed in on it. And here's what she said. Cut 35.
If I were Caitlin Clark, I would have punched her in the face. But I'm from New York, and I would have told her to f*** off. That would actually cure the problem, because I've known Kennedy since she was in high school here in Dallas. She's a tough kid. She's a really good basketball player. She's going to come after you because she's very physical, which is okay. But damn, where is Caitlin Clark's teammates? I'd be pissed at my teammates if nobody came to my defense. You know, Gretzky had an enforcer. Michael Jordan had Oakley. Honestly, it's just bullshit. Indiana has to be better.
What? I did not know she cursed like that. It sounds like Eric when we got together the other night. I mean, I feel like that is so very much like our lunch.
It is. The profanity just flies when we're not on the air.
Right.
But it's true. Like, what? After Caitlin Clark was checked, her teammate looked at the other bench and laughed about it and helped up Clark. But she should have been a little ticked off.
They don't like her either. Meanwhile, Indiana's the worst team in the league. No one's going to the games for the last 2 years. Here's more from Nancy Lieberman. Cut 36.
In 1984, when Michael Jordan came into the league, he changed the economics of the league financially, with the GLA, with all the TV contracts. He was on TV every game. Arenas were filled. When Tiger Woods was tearing up the PGA when he first started, he changed the PGA world for every golfer financially. You know, people need to thank Caitlin Clark for being that generational athlete that is making them wealthy. They will have generational wealth. They would not have airplanes, charter jets without her. They wouldn't have been on, you know, TV.
I mean, they're going to have to realize that sooner or later. But the only problem is, if she goes this whole year and is not that effective, team doesn't do that well, and then she comes out next year and doesn't shine, do people start, it comes down to performance.
It does, but it also comes down to, are people going to still go see her in the arenas around the country, right? I was reading a piece how someone from, like, Brooklyn went to go see her. Never been to a WNBA game in their life, and they went, and they said it was fantastic.
So right, a good atmosphere. Yeah. Women are really good players. Did you see last night the Mavericks lose on the road, as expected, to the Celtics?
I didn't see it, but I heard about it.
But we're going to Dallas next week, at which time we need to have the people of Dallas in a good mood. So I think we need the Mavericks to split and take the next game in Boston. Could you arrange that?
I think you have connections. Give Mr.
Cuban
a text.
Should we get Mark Cuban on next week?
That would be fun.
Right. Now, who has more money, me or him?
Let me look that up. I'll get back to you.
Can you Google that?
Okay.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. Thanks so much for listening all week long. We're going to be joined. At the bottom of the hour by Keith Cowing, the editor of NASA Watch. Kind of an exciting week. Boeing got their rocket, manned rocket into the sky, went to the space station. SpaceX followed with a massive, super heavy Starship who returned to Earth without exploding. The first two times did, and Elon Musk said, yeah, I'm not really upset with it. And I thought to myself, he's covering for it, but he wasn't. He says, you got to do this in order to get it right. Now they got it right, return back to Earth. This is the type of rocket that's going to get us to the moon and beyond. And it's from the private sector with cooperation with NASA. We'll discuss that. Now, Ian Pryor's here, author of Parents of the World Unite. He's also a senior advisor at America's First Legal and executive director of Fight for Schools. But meanwhile, there's a lot going on today, the Hunter Biden trial back in action. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Hallie Biden described the moment she found and then discarded the gun, which is at the heart of this case. On Thursday, she told the jury she discovered a revolver and ammunition along with drug residue and drug paraphernalia while searching her brother-in-law Hunter Biden's car on October 23rd, 2018.
That is the CBS reporting the Hunter's hijinks on full display has become clear that the laptop was always real and Hunter's crack-loving, hedonistic, irresponsible behavior included getting his brother's widow addicted to crack. Nice.
Number two.
But to enforce the Biden strategy, that is why they never have given Ukraine the advanced weapon system they want, because they feared Russian escalation. And also, when they did get the advanced weapon system, restricted the use of them.
That was General Jack Keane. Ukraine-U.S. relations beginning to fray as the White House can't seem to get them from the weapons we have sent over, $65 billion worth, nor can we train pilots.
Number one.
It is not the only poll that has showed Virginia within the margin of error, but it is the most recent and reputable one that we have. That's an astonishing number to see. And that a state like Virginia, if that gets into the real toss-up category, your math to 270 becomes a lot more complicated.
That was CNN reporting, reluctantly. The 2024 polls are in, and it's good for the former president, especially when it comes to New Hampshire, especially when it comes to Virginia. We're going to look at all sides and where that vote is going. First, Ian, as a guy that's been working hard with the schools, pointing out the outrage in Virginia schools, as a Virginia resident, were you shocked to see 48-48 Trump and Biden, where Trump lost by 10 points last time out?
A little shocked to see it tied, but we've been seeing in Virginia that it's not going to be the 10 point Biden victory that it was in 2020. The polls have slowly been narrowing, but to see it tied like that, you know, I think when you look at Virginia, when you look at 2021, and then, you know, you had two elections, because you always have an election every year in Virginia, 2022, 2023, it didn't go like 2021 did. So why in 24 are we looking at, again, potentially a Republican candidate winning? I think it's the leadership issue. I think that, you know, sometimes you may have some of these policy issues that may win over voters at either the local level, the Commonwealth level, or even the congressional level. But people are thirsting for leadership. And right now, when you look at President Biden, you're seeing an absolute lack of leadership and a lack of cognition.
Yeah, it's not like everything's going good and he's just faltering on stage in front of people. We're seeing a lack of – it's almost as if the White House is running an automatic pilot, just people doing their jobs without anybody on the top. Now I look at this poll. Going inside the numbers in Virginia, black voters, Joe Biden's got 73% of the vote. Trump's got 25. It's usually 8. Romney, McCain – usually single or barely double digits. Suburban women, usually a big advantage for Joe Biden. It's still big, 58-38, so he's got it by 20. And then the rest is all Trump. So I'm wondering how much credit Glenn, this is just your opinion, Ian, how much credit Glenn Youngkin gets.
Well, you know, I think that the election of 2021, you know, really motivated people. I think that, you know, for a while, Virginia had been a blue state. And seeing that election, seeing Youngkin win in 2021, it really energized certainly the base, but you know, Republicans, conservatives in Virginia say, you know, we can win this. Let's start putting together a program where, you know, we're going to be able to deliver this state to, you know, a Republican candidate. We're going to be able to put together an organization that can really push forward. And I think you're starting to see that. And I think, you know, Governor Youngkin has helped build back that party apparatus in the Commonwealth that can be competitive.
Right. But you did not have a great midterm. Was that because abortion was on the docket?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that
you had from a Republican perspective.
Yeah, no, I certainly think that was the issue that was constantly on air. You know, one of the candidates got caught on a hot mic. They played that ad over and over and over again in multiple markets, even markets where this candidate wasn't running. And so I think that the messaging, the constant drumbeat on this issue really just took over. I don't think you're going to have that in 2024 because you're dealing with a presidential election. This is no longer a federal issue. It's a state issue.
You already voted on it.
Yeah, and there are certainly bigger issues that are at the forefront, whether it's immigration, whether it's national security, the economy, inflation, all of these things, the weaponization of the Justice Department, all of these things are on the ballot. I think that, you know, some of the other issues that have percolated over the past couple of years are going to take second tier to those top issues.
All right. So when you talk about what's happening with the Hunter Biden trial, people are talking about the exact inverse of what happened with Trump, in that you have a jury that everybody on that jury knows Joe Biden and had some type of bout with addiction personally or within their family and friends. And people see the first lady in the front row from the legal profession, even though it looks like he's dead to rights with buying a gun and checking the box that said he had no drug problem. A lot of people feel as though he's going to get acquitted.
Well, you know, going into any criminal trial, it's obviously harder to convict. All you need is one juror, right? And one juror says, I'm not going to vote to convict. Then you've got a hung jury. And certainly they're looking for a jury nullification strategy, which is, yeah, you may be able to prove all the elements. You may be able to prove all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. But if you've got that one, two, three jurors that say, you know, I just don't want to do it, they can hold out. You've got a hung jury. And then, you know, then it depends on, are they going to go again? Now, President Biden said, well, I'll pardon him. Question I'd ask
says
is,
he won't pardon.
Oh, yeah, I won't pardon him. The question I have is, if there's a hung jury, will the Department of Justice come back and try it again?
Interesting, because they waited a long time. Now, the people should understand that it's not that he's being targeted. One of the things that happened is they had a deal. How would you describe the deal that was in place that blew up once the judge got a look at it?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was last summer, right? Can you refresh my memory on that? Because I remember reading about it.
So basically, he was going to be totally exonerated. He'd be exempt from being charged. He'd get immunity for it and essentially community service. And they said, you got to be kidding me. Who cut this deal? Both sides say, we agreed on it. Then they said they didn't see it. Then a lot of it was statute of limitations had been up on it. So then David Weiss almost got embarrassed to bring in a real charge.
And that's what it came down to, right, is political optics. You know, once that story broke, once everybody realized what was happening, that they're trying to game the system here, they have to do it. And that now they have to put their best foot forward, or at least appear to put their best foot forward, so that it doesn't look like justice is being applied, you know, unequally.
Here's the thing that I really don't care what happens to Hunter. I think he's a bad guy. I think the what really put the nail in the coffin for me was getting his Haley Biden introduced to crack. I mean, I know when you're an addict, you're an addict. But this guy was not leading a Skid Row lifestyle. He was at the Ritz, locked up for 4 days with a prostitute, going on, getting a beautiful new race car and going 150 miles an hour to Las Vegas. I mean, if you look at what was going on there, he didn't seem to be struggling. Having said all that, at the base of this case is this laptop. And at the base of the case is when this laptop was public 4 years ago, anybody who retweeted it got suspended, this story. Anyone who brought it up was playing into Russia's hands. And then when it turns out this was necessarily not Russian disinformation, the 50 that signed off on it didn't pay the price, and it absolutely affected the election. And for it to be used now by the government against Hunter Biden is beyond ironic.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are two things that sort of stick out with this trial. One, obviously, is Hunter Biden. You know, a son of a president. I mean, we've never seen this before where, you know, the children of our presidential family are engaged in this kind of behavior. So that, of course, has a lot of impact. But the laptop issue, and I, you know, you see the left and you saw them with the national security experts saying this is Russian misinformation, and then Biden at the debate saying this is misinformation. They lied.
That affected the debate.
They lied. And it's, you know, look, it's never just the crime. Right. It's the cover up. And they covered this up, and it did impact the election. I mean, whether it would have swung the election, we don't know. Would it have impacted the election? Certainly.
Here is a look back at 2020 with Clapper, Wolf Blitzer, other experts, different channels weighing in. Cut 30.
This is just classic textbook Soviet Russian tradecraft at work.
This laptop that intelligence officials have warned is likely Russian disinformation.
Ongoing Russian disinformation effort.
It is so obviously a Russian operation.
We still think that the stories from the fall about your son Hunter were Russian disinformation as a scare campaign, like you said.
Yes, yes, yes. God love you, man.
You're a one-trick pony, went on to say. So they all knew they were lying there. And when Hunter sat down for his interviews for a book that he wrote, knowing this stuff was all in there and damning, he also knew he was lying when he says, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the concern here, I think, goes beyond just the president of the United States lying. The concern here is all these former intelligence officials coming out and lying to the American people. That should be a very big concern, is that our intelligence community that is supposed to be keeping us safe from, you know, foreign powers, foreign terrorists, whatnot, instead they're interfering in elections in this country through deception. So they are taking everything that they've learned while working at whatever agency they worked at, and they are now applying that domestically. Now, sure, they may not be in those agencies anymore, but that should be a very big concern for the future of this country.
Hey, look at John, you know, expect John Brennan. He's a political hack. But what about Leon Panetta? I mean, this guy was CIA director. Michael Hayden, a former CIA director. I mean, look at the people that were on this list. Why wouldn't one of them pick up the phone and say, Joe, is this your son? Because they want me to sign off on this.
Yeah, and it's a big problem because you talk about Panetta, and I was watching a series that's on Amazon Prime. It's the 30 Years War, right? And it was basically World War I and World War II. And you've got Leon Panetta talking and, you know, talking about the history. And so when people see this, they develop respect for them. Absolutely. In these nonpartisan areas, right? And they say, well, Leon Panetta, I mean, he's a smart guy. He must know what's going on. And so they have this inherent bias to believe these individuals because of perhaps their work on other things, and they have to be more responsible. Just don't say anything. You know, if you don't want to get involved, don't get involved. Don't let yourself be used as a pawn in these political battles that, you know, really strike at the heart of what intelligence communities are not supposed to be doing.
Ian, with your – I'm talking to Ian Pryor here. Ian, with your experience, what was Donald Trump convicted of last week?
I have no idea. If four people agree to this or four people agree to that, it's very confusing to understand what he was actually convicted of.
Should Joe Biden be forced to answer that question at the debate?
I mean, absolutely.
He's a lawyer, man.
Absolutely.
He almost finished at the top of his class in Syracuse.
Is he a lawyer? Yeah, that's right. He finished at the top of his class, the top of the bottom.
Top of the bottom.
Fifth of his class, yeah.
Right, fifth from the bottom. So he is talking about that, and he's talking about it's wrong. It's wrong to criticize the verdict. He says he got a fair trial. I think that's pretty rich coming from him. He's sitting down with David Muir, something he rarely does, and that's an interview. And when he sits down with him, they were talking about this trial, and he says it's un-American to make a comment on the jury. Cut to.
Stop undermining the rule of law. Stop undermining the institutions. That's what this whole effort is. All the MAGA Republicans are coming out saying this was a fix. This was a jury that this was a judge that set up to get Trump. There's no evidence of any of that. None. He's trying to undermine it. Look, he got a fair trial. The jury spoke like they speak in all cases, and it should be respected.
Is it un-American to comment on it, how the jury verdict?
Well, no, and this is the same president that every time a United States Supreme Court decision comes out that he doesn't like, spends a week blasting the Supreme Court. So which is it? Either you respect the decision or you don't respect the decision, but be consistent.
Right.
Obviously, we know that, you know, this is something that the Democrats wanted so that they can put, you know, $1 billion of TV ads up there and say, you're going to vote for a convicted felon, which doesn't seem to really matter at this point. I mean, whatever way the election goes, I don't think that's going to be that much of a factor.
The New York Times story that said there's a lot of people out there who are felons. They either feel as though they're wronged or they're better now. They reformed and they can't, and they feel society looks down on them. And when you start ripping Trump and saying convicted felon, that resonates in a way that they're probably not happy with.
Well, and I also think that when you look at what happened to him, a lot of people are going to say, you know what?
What did he do?
Well, not just that, but okay, they did to him the same thing they're doing to a bunch of other people, you know, right, that don't have access to lawyers, that don't have access to, you know, money to pay for a solid criminal defense, right? And they're like, that guy, you know, all right, he gets me, right? He understands.
50 Cent actually
right,
came out and said that. Ian, great to see you.
You too.
Are you doing Outnumbered?
Yeah.
So you'll be at the top of the hour.
Yep.
All right, great. So Ian Pryor is going to be an Outnumbered in about 3 hours. Make sure you watch on the channel. When we come back, I'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. And we're monitoring everything at the trial and the latest events from Normandy. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
How about an effort to deliver affordable health care? An effort to deliver affordable housing? Lay out your platform. We elected a president who has a platform that he's laid out to the American people. The last time the former president ran, he refused to do a platform. And if a political party decides not to lay out a platform for the American people, everything is going on in the head of the principal, That's the problem for me.
James Clyburn weighing in on Tim Scott putting $14 million into the black vote and leading the charge there with the super PAC. And he's saying, Tim Scott's a friend of mine, but I want to see a platform. Neil Cavuto pushed him and said, why should he be a platform? He wants to put money into the black community in order to find out what they want to vote for and see if he could provide that with the Trump with his influence with the Trump administration should he get in. Obviously, Tim Scott would be in that cabinet if he's not the vice president in some way, shape, or form. But James Clyburn, what exactly you could say? It's kind of old fashioned to come out with a platform. Who cares? No one sticks to it anyway. I would like to know what they're going to do, but that'll come out when you get into the community. Greg in the Villages. Hey, Greg.
Thank you. I want to speak directly to Mr. Trump because I know that he listens to your show. You're his favorite show. I'm very frustrated that he doesn't take every opportunity to make it about his struggles to be about the American people. Like, how many African Americans have lied on federal forms, like checking the box that they're not addicted to drugs or, you know, and then been convicted of lying? Only a Biden could get away with something like that.
That would be a great analogy. Let's see what happens first. And then I would not be surprised if he did bring that up. But keep in mind, he's going to be in control of a country that he wants people to believe in the justice system, but just that there's two tiers with certain people in certain parties. So good point. Let's see if he gets off, though. Right now, he looks dead to rights.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V, carrying two American heroes, drawing a line to the stars for all of us.
3, 2, 1. We have liftoff.
All right, 30 seconds into flight. The rumbles are still building here in the Raptor's nest. We're seeing 32 out of 33 engines lit on the Super Heavy right now.
That is key. That is the liftoff of two separate rockets, one by Boeing, the first, the second one by SpaceX. That was the Super Heavy Starship. It was shot into space and then returned to Earth without exploding for the first time. So it shows great progress. What was the objective and how significant was that successful launch, a manned launch for Boeing? Let's bring in Keith Cowing, editor of NASA Watch. Keith, what a week for rockets, right?
Yeah, that's an understatement.
So first off, the significance of what was Boeing trying to do with this manned launch? They had trouble getting it off. They had some technical issues. So first off, let's look at that. What did they accomplish?
Well, first of all, the first time you fly a spaceship is often there's a problem. Once you get it up there, you get the cadence going, it's fine after that. They just took them a little longer, cost a bit more money than SpaceX. SpaceX was sort of the rabbit in the hare. They were the rabbit or the roadrunner, and Boeing had to catch up. But Boeing's there, and the spacecraft is doing okay. And hopefully now we'll have two American ways to get to the space station. So if one doesn't work, the other does. That's the important part. We have a redundancy, right, and it's all American.
So Boeing, you had these two pilots in there, so astronauts in there now. So what would they want to do? They're going to the space station?
Yeah, they're both going up for a week. This is a test flight. It's like, let's get in it, fly it to the space station, dock it, take things out, put things in, make sure it works, come home. If that's okay, the next time it goes up, we'll have four or five people, and it'll become an operational spacecraft as a partner or a backup to SpaceX and vice versa. That's the whole idea of having two.
Is the ultimate objective to get back to the moon with this technology or not?
Yes and no. America, it's interesting. We have two commercial ways now to get to the space station. We have a third capsule called Orion, which is designed to go to the moon. And then your next question is going to be about Starship. Starship is bigger than everything together, but Starship will become part of what we land on the moon. So every week we're going to get something new, and we're going to have quite a capability very soon to go and just do all kinds of things in space.
So, yeah, with Elon Musk's spaceship, Starship, the Starship, twice it blew up before. Tell me what did they decide went wrong, and why weren't they seemingly more transparently upset by the two failures?
Well, here's the thing. There's two ways to do rockets. You could do it the NASA way with the Space Launch System. You can take years and years and spend a lot of money and say, oh, we're not ready. We don't want it to blow up. Whereas with SpaceX, it was like the Barnstormer days. You fly the plane, it crashes. Okay, I need better canvas next time. And they do this flight test. And it's been how SpaceX has done things since day one. And they even had a blooper reel for their Falcon 9 because, you got to accept the risk. But every time you do this, like yesterday when the thing was coming back, the flap was melting and you could hear all the SpaceX people going, but it worked. But now they know next time they got to fix that flap. Whereas with NASA, they think about it for 5 years and then launch once and cross their fingers. Two different approaches. Mm-hmm. The end result is you have more than one way to do more than one thing. That's always good to have.
Elon texts saying congratulations to Boeing. Are they in competition or does he really mean it? Is he glad to have company up there?
Elon's interesting. He is sort of like Mercedes-Benz when they had the airbags. They said, we're not going to enforce that patent. It's a good thing for everybody. Elon has said that about a lot, his cars and his rockets and so forth. His idea is sort of, a rising tide lifts all boats. You've got Rocket Lab flying out of New Zealand now, and they're sort of copying part of what SpaceX did. But it's like any business. The more people that want to do it, the more ways to do it, the more things there are to do. And it's, right. Again.
Well, it's important. So we know the Chinese have now landed on the dark side of the moon again. They laid out their flag. What are the Chinese up to? And why is NASA so reluctant to admit they were in competition with them? I'm always told that they don't want to ever comment about what other people are doing when they can use that to motivate the public to support the program.
Well, it's interesting. I'm 68, so I remember you weren't there, but I remember the Apollo day when it was us and the Russians. It was quite obvious, Team A and Team B. And it was competition. Now we live in a multipolar world where you can collaborate, you can cooperate, and you can compete all in the same day with a whole bunch of different people. So it's not unipolar, as they would say, as it was. That said, China's, they watched how we did it. They watched how other countries did it, and they picked the best way to do it. And they're doing it because they want to do it. It's not like we can't do it. It's just that they're being very proactive. They're doing one thing, then improving it, doing it better. And the funny thing is, if you look at what landed on the far side of the moon, you look at the bottom stage, and then you look at the pictures of what China shows of what their moon lander with people looks like, it's just bigger. They've got this all figured out. We could do it, too. We just got to want to do it.
Yeah, so they want to put somebody on the moon. They want to get some people there. So why are we having such trouble putting people back there? Is it the way we're looking to do it? I mean, when I was over doing a couple of features with NASA, they were saying that they want to be able to land people who aren't dependent on Earth to be able to grow their own food, make their own have their own supplies. Do you think that's where we should be heading? And do you agree that that's NASA's focus? Which is why it's taking so long?
Yeah, down the road. I mean, it's sort of, you got to think expeditionary. And I've been on expeditions near the North Pole and the Himalayas. And it's one thing to go there, visit, and leave. It's another to go there and stay longer and longer and longer, and then eventually live there. I mean, that's how, the Western world was settled and so forth. You got to start somewhere. And we went and did, a bunch of trips back in the 60s, half a century ago. And then we didn't go back for half a century. And that's what we did with the North Pole, South Pole. They went there. All right, we did it. And then they didn't go back overland for another 50 years. So we're like that as a species. But now we're going back, and we're not the only ones going back. The Russians are interested. The Japanese are interested. The Indians, UAE, China. So it's a world wanting to go back now, which gives you a whole bunch of different reasons all at the same time. And we got to sort of sort our way through it. But to your original question, why haven't we gone back? They told me when I was a little kid, we're going to land on the moon by the end of the decade. We did it. Hooray. We're going to go to Mars by 1981. All right. Well, I would have been in college. I'll be in my 80s before we go to Mars.
Right.
Imagine how frustrated I am.
I know. And to get people down there, we got great probes and great studies. But now the skies are all littered now with satellite technology. Who else is competing up in that space? You got Russia, China. India is doing the same thing. North Korea wants to be doing this. Are we militarizing space?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I mean, yesterday was D-Day anniversary. My dad was there. And a year later, he was in London, and a V-2 rocket went through space and came, really close to killing him. His roommates never came home. So we've been using space, going through space for military purposes for, you know, 80 years. It's just now, and we've been doing it ever since. The first rocket John Glenn went on was a modified ICBM. Yuri Gagarin, the same thing. It's just how much right. The focus is. Luckily, with America, we've been really open and transparent and really big on commercial and science and civilian space, in addition to the military. With other countries like Russia and China, good luck figuring it out.
Well, it's interesting because we're really concerned that China is practicing knocking and being able to shoot satellites out of the sky. And Russia is beginning to send rockets into the sky to see if they can line us up because they're looking, you know, we're heading towards some type of confrontation. And they're looking to blind us by taking out satellites. Do you agree with that? And do you right if you're in Space Force and worried about this?
Well, we can do it too. This is the thing is we've had the ability to shoot down satellites for quite some time. We showed that we could do it with an F-15 and a missile. So it's not impossible to do this. It's another to plan methodically to have stuff up there ready to go. And, you know, I'm not privy to what the U.S. has done, and we may have that capability. It's not, quite frankly, you know, for your readers and your watchers on YouTube, if I had a rock this big, it's in my hand, traveling at orbital speeds, I didn't have to have any brains. I just have to aim it. And if it hits something else, kaboom. So this isn't really, there's really little rocket science in a rock, you know. It's more about your thinking and strategically and planning for this. So, yeah, it's an issue. But I'll tell you the flip side of all this, and that is when you use these weapons, you're going to destroy a lot of your own stuff. So you got to be willing. It's sort of like mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
You got to be assuming that a lot of your satellites are going to get fried or smashed too.
That's a good point, Keith. Keith, are we still leading in this technology? Do you feel as though America's still leading the space race?
Yeah, it may not look like it because when you say, yeah, when China's landing on the moon, but, you know, I've said this on TV. Yeah, we did it 50 years ago. We haven't done it since, which is frustrating, but we did do it. We can do it better now. And this isn't an issue of they're smarter than us. It's like they're saying, well, hey, they figured out how to do it. We're going to do it. We just in the country here, we just have to decide to make the decision to do things, either private sector, public sector, cooperation, work with friendly nations, and just go do it. And it's not expensive. I mean, we spend more money on bubblegum and pizza and, you know, dog grooming parlors than we do in outer space.
So, Keith, we got SpaceX. Now we got Boeing's in there. We've got NASA still doing stuff overall. So we're putting more emphasis into this private to the private sector. You have the private sector work with NASA publicly. But in the big picture, do you think NASA should do a better job selling itself? Talk about the excitement and the opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, boy, singing to my heart here. I've been doing NASA Watch for nearly 30 years, and it started with, you know, this isn't a NASA website. Be careful. You might learn something. I mean, NASA, some of the stuff that NASA does is such incredibly powerful. It's soft power. It should be in the dictionary of soft power. And you see kids in little countries, you know, where they're just getting satellite communications for the first time. They have a NASA logo T-shirt. It's the emblem of how you do the impossible. Yeah. And it's NASA and it's America. So, you know, like you see the bags that show up for food and say, you know, thanks from the people of America. Well, the NASA logo does that, too. But NASA can also make space boring, which is just baffling. You know, they'll sit there like yesterday they were like, hey, Boeing went to the space station. Meanwhile, this monstrous American-made rocket is taking off. And they put one tweet out. Hey, good job, Elon. And yet, they're, you know, it's just like, who's in charge of the strategery here in terms of how we should do things? And also, you know, everybody in America is paying for this. And why aren't we focusing on the little agricultural towns in the middle of nowhere where we've got our Starlink now? They're just excited about space. They have nice skies to look up at. You know, they use GPS. And NASA they just go with the usual. And it's unfortunate because we have 300 million potential space fans out there. NASA's reaching 1% of them.
Just kind of rapid fire. First off, we know the Chinese are taking this, the moon Earth. They're taking that down. They're mining like crazy. Do you think that could be another area in which we could commercialize? Should we? And what about space tourism? Do you think that's a good thing, or does it look like billionaires who are bored looking just to challenge themselves?
Well, I'll do the space mining thing first. The moon is pretty big. We could be water there. Water you can use for rocket fuel, for breathing, for so forth. I don't agree that, you know, some people say that China's going to claim the bottom of the moon. If they're going to, what are they going to do? Send soldiers there? If they wanted to stop us, they should have aircraft carriers off the coast of Florida to shoot our rockets down before they leave Earth. So I think there's a lot there, you know. Second, the space tourism, I'll go tomorrow. I've had some friends take things up. It's expensive. Maybe you should talk to your producers about your travel budget. Maybe you could, yeah, you should try that.
I should try that because there is no column for space, but maybe miscellaneous.
Yeah. There you go. But should rich people? It's always like this. I mean, you watch the Indiana Jones movie. He's drinking the champagne, flying the plane. And that's how it started. Rich people did this thing, and eventually somebody says, "Hey, I could do it cheaper." When that'll happen, I don't know. I can't wait. I may be too old, but you know, it's got to start somewhere. Right. Someone's got to have fun first.
Lastly, the asteroid mining. Why do we do it? What do we get from it?
Well, if we do it, and it's funny because you hear this thing about, we're going to go visit this $100 trillion asteroid. Okay, it's based on current market. But aluminum used to be, I mean, the top of the Washington Monument, you said it's a little piece of aluminum because it was so rare. Now you just, you know, are these asteroids going to be worth trillions of dollars? No, because if you brought it back to Earth, the price would crash. But if you want to build stuff in space, get the raw materials in space instead of launching them from Earth. Then you're going to make some money.
Understood. Keith, lastly, is Space Force working out?
Yeah, I think I always wonder why they have camouflage uniforms. They're going to outer space. Shouldn't it be like James Bond?
A unitard. Seriously. We could get a unit. Yeah. If any branch needs a unitard, I think it's that, right? Absolutely. No more camouflage. We pretty much know you're in a rocket. Thanks so much, Keith. Great point. Editor of NASA Watch.
My pleasure.
All right. It's been an exciting week. Two launches this week. You see what's out there. 1-866-408-7669. If you want to write me, BrianKilmeade.com, and I'll go through it. Keep in mind, One Nation coming up Saturday at 9 o'clock. I have a two-part look at my interview with Dana White of the UFC. Might be the most successful sports executive in the world. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Dawn, 6th of June, 1944. The wind was pounding as it is today, and always has against these cliffs. 225 American Rangers arrived by ship, jumped into the waves, and stormed the beach. They could see, all they could see was the outline of the shore and the enormity of these cliffs. And I'd like to look, I know I'll get in trouble with the Secret Service if I go to the edge and look over, but think of those cliffs as my hostess showed me. That's what we're standing on top of. They could hear, all they could hear was the crack of bullets hitting ships, sand, rocks, hitting everything. All they knew was time was of the essence. They had only 30 minutes to eliminate the Nazi guns high on this cliff. Guns that could halt the Allied invasion before it even began.
That was President Biden trying to channel President Reagan, which is impossible. They'll never be able to do it. He does not. He's not eloquent. Not a good speaker. But he pulled it off. It seems when he ad-libbed a little, Allison, it was a little painful.
It was a little painful. Know when not to go off script.
Right. You know, those cliffs, man, the Secret Service is going to get mad at me if I look over there. Everyone gets mad at him when he does anything, right? He's always talking about...
But to be fair, he's not the surest human being on his feet, so you don't want him standing near
right.
a cliff.
I mean, I'm not... Even when he got off, it looked like it was a little bit too close. So, I mean, let's say he pulled it off. The one thing to keep in mind, too, that other speech yesterday was solid. It was solid for him. And when this was solid... Donald Trump should not assume, and I don't think he is, that he's going to show up and just fumble all over himself and barely be audible like it's rumored to be doing behind the closed doors. And with David Muir, he basically is whispering. He should assume that he's going to come out there and be sharp for whatever reason. And we'll see. His wife was not there. The First Lady not there. Where is she?
She is with Hunter at trial, which is a little bit of nonsense. Let's take the flight home just to be there. Right.
Right.
Shouldn't she be
on
in
our
France?
Dollar.
Yeah.
By the way, on our dollar, so he's got to go. I guess she wants to support her son, but, you know, fly Delta. All right, if you're going to don't make me pay for the fact that your son was doing crack and hookers every single day. while getting your former daughter-in-law hooked to it as well. So President Biden is now leaving the frame. We're going to take a timeout, but keep in mind, BrianKilmeade.com. Find out when I'm going to be in Indianapolis end of June and then in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania in July.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being with us all week long, everyone. Brian Kilmeade, a lot going on. The President of the United States finished up his speech at Point du Hoc. That's where the Green Berets climbed the cliffs in order to get through enemy lines against the Third Reich, against Hitler's army. And then when you see that they lost maybe 45 guys climbing up a cliff that I couldn't even climb up without anyone shooting at me, it's just stunning. Stunning to see what happens. I mean, we're used to our special ops doing extraordinary things back then, but obviously they're the best of the best, and these were great athletes who, to a degree, were fearless. Shannon Bream's going to be with us in a matter of moments. And also Batya Unger-Sargon, author of Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. We also have Fox polls out you probably have not seen, so we'll get to that. But first, let's bring in Shannon Bream. Shannon, welcome back. But, you know, the good news is Shannon's not ready, so I do not have to go to her. So we'll get her in just a second. But I will say this. We just got word the prosecution has rested in the Hunter Biden trial. Interesting. That's what we thought yesterday. It bled until today. We'll see how long the defense needs, because to me, they need a good story to tell. And maybe it's going to be with the First Lady on the stand today. Is that why she left France? And let her husband speak without being there, who clearly needs some support? Shannon Bream, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I know you're getting set for Fox News Sunday, which according to reports airs on Sunday.
You are correct. And this weekend it's going to be in New York City.
Really?
No. Yeah. I mean, I've got the restraining order lifted for the weekend, so I'll be able to be there in the same proximity with you.
All right. That's great. So who's going to be on?
We're going to have Senator Tom Cotton on with us, reportedly on the Trump VP shortlist. Of course, all this foreign policy stuff going on, too. That's deep on his resume. But we also have Congressman Richie Torres, Democrat there in New York. Listen, he covers that South Bronx area that was just host to a Trump rally. So we'll talk about that, too.
All right, that's great. So just on, first off, from the Hunter Biden trial, tapping into your legal knowledge, it looks at the prosecution rests. This is what I'm getting, Shannon, and we're the layman on the outside. You're the insider. That the evidence is overwhelming, but there's a huge sympathetic factor with the jury, some of which were crying yesterday, that makes people feel as though they're going to say, Attic, made a mistake. We've been there. You're free.
Well, think about it. I mean, like, Delaware is obviously very, very friendly Biden country for the Biden family. Very much in contrast to what President Trump faced in Manhattan, where, you know, 85%+ probably voted for President Biden in 2020. So this is a very different situation. We all know, just like in the Trump trial, all you need is one juror to say, I'm not going to vote to convict. And then you have a hung jury situation. I agree with you, what you were saying on the intro. Like, I thought it was so strange when I heard that the First Lady was going to fly back and forth to France and Italy twice, not just once. And so that really does beg the question if she's there, you know, to give him moral support, which he clearly needs, but whether she will take the stand, because otherwise, man, that travel is absolutely whiplash.
And by the way, we're paying for it. You know, it's not like she's hopping on United.
Well, you know, I mean, that might slow her down a little bit.
That could. So I want you to hear what Joe Biden said about President Trump's trial. Cut two.
Stop undermining the rule of law. Stop undermining institutions. That's what this whole effort is. All the MAGA Republicans are coming out saying this was a fix. This was a jury that this was a judge that set up to get Trump. There's no evidence of any of that. None. He's trying to undermine it. Look, he got a fair trial. The jury spoke like they speak in all cases, and it should be respected.
Now, that's kind of rich, isn't it?
Well, it is, having sat through a lot of that trial and watched the decisions that were made by Judge Marchon, questions about, you know, his family, his donations, the jury instructions. I mean, I think there's a lot of fertile ground for the Trump team on appeal, especially the idea that you have to, under the Sixth Amendment, tell defendants what they're charged with so they can defend themselves. Not at the last minute when the defense is already done, they find out the jury instructions. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that people across the legal and political spectrum say it's problematic.
Right. Now, there's a sense, and I watched Andy McCabe yesterday say, I really believe, and people in the intel community believe, former FBI agent, by the way, that Donald Trump is going to try to put us in jail if he wins. This is what he said last night. Cut 9.
How would it be I win and I lock Hillary Clinton up? The president's wife, the former president's wife, I locked her up. And how would it be if I took the Secretary of State, your Secretary of State, and we threw her into a prison someplace? I think it was terrible. And yet now they're trying to do that with me. Think of it. I didn't want to do that.
So he's saying, why do people want me to lock her up? Now he's getting pressure. And by the way, so one of the people that was on him is Governor Ron DeSantis said the president said he was going to go after Hillary Clinton and lock her up, and he never did. So he's trying to explain to people it's not right really to go for redemption, but they are doing it to me, and I might change my mind.
Well, you know, he keeps saying whenever he's pressed on this question, like, you know, revenge is the best thing, deliver a success, you know, like I'm going to go here and change the country and everybody's going to love me and be happy and we won't have to fight like this. But there are a lot of Republicans after that ruling last week who've come out and said, you have got to turn around and fight fire with fire. We've talked about the John Yoo piece that he wrote, Berkeley professor from the Bush administration, Bush 43. And he said, listen, that's the only thing they understand. And so he's encouraging Republican AGs and DAs and places all over the country to think about going after Democrats in the way that he feels they went after President Trump. Now, does that, you know, put us into a situation where it's just ratcheting up to no end? I mean, there's got to be an off-ramp for that somewhere. But President Trump is right when he says, listen, everybody wanted me to go after Hillary. I decided, you know, that wasn't the thing to do as president. I wasn't going to go there. But he's got a lot of people pushing him to reconsider that kind of thinking should he win again.
So Dr. Phil sat down with President Trump, and Donald Trump knows he's a psychiatrist, as you watched him for years. Listen to this exchange. Cut 6.
I think you have so much to do, you don't have time to get even. You only have time to get right.
Well, revenge does take time, I will say that.
It does.
And sometimes revenge can be justified, Phil. I have to be honest. You know, sometimes it can.
But is the country better or worse for them going after you?
I think the country is really worse for what they've done.
Interesting, right?
Yes, and I love that President Trump is like, hey, I know you're a psychiatrist. Maybe I'm getting some therapy right now. he was talking about how he loved the idea of when they called him about doing. He's like, oh, yeah, this guy's a psychiatrist. This is going to be an interesting interview. But he said maybe he needs some therapy. I mean, listen, most of us would need therapy if we were facing what President Trump has been facing.
I get stressed thinking about it. I can't imagine living through it. And one thing he said last night is that he doesn't think about it. His way of fighting with it is not thinking about it.
You know what? That struck me, too, is watching him in the courtroom where, you know, he did have his eyes closed a lot, and he would say he was resting his beautiful baby blues. I believe that's a quote. But I was really struck the last day or two during closing arguments and the jury instructions when he sat back and closed his eyes. It really felt to me like he was trying to go somewhere else, which when I heard him say this to Dr. Phil, I thought maybe that is part of his coping strategy, is that he just kind of like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to hear this. I know this is not good for me potentially. Right. And he does kind of a mental checkout.
You know, it's interesting, Shannon, that was a big criticism from the networks. He closed his eyes. He's falling asleep. Mm-hmm. Number one, as somebody who gets on the train at 3 o'clock, no matter what, how upbeat I am, as soon as I sit, my adrenaline drops and I fall asleep. But I totally understand it, even though I heard it was an ice box in there enough.
But think about it. He couldn't have his Diet Cokes he likes to have. He's not interacting with people. He couldn't have phones. Like, he couldn't communicate.
Why can't you have coffee or something? You can't have coffee or anything?
Water was it. That was it. So I think that to put him to a grinding halt when he's somebody who feeds off the energy of other people, whether it's good or bad, I think he likes fighting. He likes, you know, yucking it up. I think for him to sit still and have no outside communication and none of his Diet Cokes, I think was tough.
All right. How about this on his family? So this is what he said. Cut 15.
Not easy, and he's a great kid. He's a good student. He's, you know, got accepted to different colleges. He's got some of those colleges, all of a sudden, they're riding all over the place. You know, you're saying, but he's a good boy. He's a tall boy. Very tall. He's very tall. And he's a great kid. He's a good-looking kid. And, you know, he's going to be going to college. But he doesn't say it, and I think he doesn't say it because he doesn't want to hurt me, and he thinks it's possibly a hurtful conversation. But it has to affect my family. And I think that's really unfair.
I mean, of course it affects his family. I mean, you see it. And you see it with Eric especially. And you have to wonder, the 17-year-old's been to three cities, been switched from New York to Washington to Florida. Now he's going to be picking a college.
I can't imagine the weight of that. I mean, just knowing that anywhere you go under any circumstance as, you know, somebody is under Secret Service protection, that's a crazy way to go to college. I mean, you've heard the Bush twins talk about it and just how wild it was. And for him and for Melania and for all of the kids to see their dad under constant attack and them to be under attack as well, I mean, that's just got to be really tough. Just like when we talk about what's going on with Hunter Biden and, you know, President Biden, you hear the voicemails, like he's clearly brokenhearted over his son when he was in the throes of addiction. But I think it hurts him very much to see him, you know, now be dragged through the public spotlight to have to deal with it. So families are never immune. I mean, there used to be a thing like, you know, kids aren't in there, but man, you saw people salivating like, I can't wait till Barron turns 18 because then all, you know, bets are off. And, you know, it feels a little vulturistic.
It does. And, you know, lastly, I want to get those emails where, sorry, you're addicted to crack, son, but if you don't mind doing that China deal, and the Moscow mayor's on the other line. So he was, while he's doing the crack, he is doing these deals, same period of time. And I was struck by one line. In it, it said the 24-year-old, I assume, prostitute, escort, whatever you want to call her, girlfriend, that he denies having relations with but lived with him for 4 days at the Ritz, said that it was amazing because I'd watch him smoke crack and it wouldn't change his personality. And I'm thinking to myself, he might have been doing some of these deals cracked out, which is crazy. If the family knows he's got a problem, you don't go, hey, I got Carlos Slim in Mexico. You want to hop on Air Force too?
Yeah, because you think about, there were times and statements that have come from Hunter over time saying that he felt the pressure of, you know, in some ways carrying the family name. And so if that really was the situation that he felt like he needed to produce for them at a time he was also struggling with addiction, like you can't imagine like what a terrible spiral that could, you know, induce. It'll be interesting to see if we do hear from the First Lady or someone else close to him, because already what we've heard from those who were close to him during the time, like he was just in a really bad place.
So there's a Supreme Court case that might make it impossible for police to pick up homeless people and put them into shelter. They would say that they're allowed to stay in the open. It's not constitutional to pick up someone and make them go to shelter. What's the impact of a case like this? I guess they call it Martin versus Boise case.
Yeah, that was one of the early cases on this where localities would say, listen, we've got thousands of people doing encampments and around schools and around all kinds of places. And we pass an ordinance to say, listen, if there's shelter available for you, you cannot be on the street. Like, you have to go somewhere else. Now, what happened is there were all kinds of lawsuits saying, well, like, hey, if the shelters are full, where do we go? We're going to stay on the streets. We're going to be in school parking lots. We're going to be wherever. So this is now another case that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court out of Grants Pass, Oregon. And we're waiting to see what they're going to say, because opponents of this say, listen, it's cruel and unusual punishment, violates the Eighth Amendment against that, and that people need to be able to camp out if that's what they got to do. These cities and states are warning, if this happens nationwide, you're going to have a problem that you cannot manage, and every city is going to have to deal with the situation that they're dealing with out west.
She is Shannon Bream. She's a lawyer. She's a talk show host. She's also a game show contestant. We know that Chuck Woolery hosted a big game show with you on it, right?
Oh, my gosh. I love him so much. He was so sweet. I think he might have been a little overwhelmed by the Shannon Bream-Janice Dean combo, because it comes on strong. It can come on real strong.
He was praising you guys.
We loved him so much. But this 80s trivia show, which it's the best decade of all time, so much fun. It's available on Fox Nation today. And see who gets crushed. You'll just have to tune in.
I can't wait. Shannon, thanks so much. I'll see you in New York City.
I'll see you Saturday night, and then everyone will see us on Sunday morning.
Yeah, Saturday, 9 o'clock. Thanks so much. Shannon Bream brings up One Nation, which is good, because we have a two-part interview with Dana White, one of the most successful sports executives in the world today, as well as Charles Payne unwinds what it takes for young people to be able to get a house. Arguably, it's harder now to get out of the rental scheme or your parents' basement than ever before. He'll explain why and maybe how to fix it. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think it's going to be a great series in the NBA playoffs. I love it because the established teams with these so-called stars who go around to get their two superstar friends and they form a team and make that city good, but they come off as mercenaries. I'm going to go to Miami. LeBron James is going to go to Miami, and he's going to win a championship with two other superstars. And Kevin Durant's going to go to the Nets. He's going to win a championship with superstars. But the best team, thankfully for the league, is now winning. That's why the Golden State Warriors were the best team with or without Kevin Durant. The two best teams got to the NBA Finals this year. Boston, best team, without the best players, and the Dallas Mavericks, another great story. Yesterday, game one went off 107-89. Porzingis was fantastic. Let's listen. This guy's been hurt. He's 7'4", 7'3", drafted by the Knicks, traded to the Mavericks, and then the Mavericks traded him to the Celtics. He single-handedly beat the Celtics last night.
Chris, that's, what did you think of the assignment Mavericks to come off the bench, I think, just for the second time of your career, and how did you find a comfort zone basically from the minute you stepped on the floor?
From day one, I came here and I said, like, I'll do whatever it takes to help this team win, right? And I think it was this situation, you know, it made sense. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I knew I could prepare to come off the bench, which is something different for me. And that's what I did, and stepped into that role and embraced it and had a good game.
He had a really good game. You know, he's got a lot of talent on that roster, playing in his home court, not a surprise. But when you could pull a guy like Porzingis off the bench, it's big. Also, he's upset because Doncic was the star in Dallas. At that point in his career, he could not take not being the focal point. And there was some friction between them, so they got rid of him. But he went to a place where he said, I just want to win a championship after going, he also went to Washington. So after going to that terrible team, he ends up in Boston. And he said, okay, enough about me. Let's go win a championship. I think it's a great time for the league. They also just got a multi-billion-dollar deal with NBC. They're going back. They're leaving TNT. The bad part is they lose one of the best pre- and post-game shows around with Shaquille O'Neal, Charles Barkley, and Kenny Smith. So that, I don't know if they're going to try to get all those guys and travel with them. My sense is they'll hire new guys. But I know among the people that are upset is Charles Barkley. He says, you guys at TNT blew it. I don't know. How much money can they have? Basically, you have NBC with football and basketball 4 to 5 nights a week in prime time. Guys, there's nothing else besides news and sports. There's nothing else that's appointment viewing out there in the world today. There's no happy days at 8 o'clock followed by Laverne and Shirley. We got to watch. We got to watch Survivor. What was that, 15 years ago? Survivor's on. We got to see what's happening. American Idol was getting, 30 million, 40 million people. We got to see who's going to win. Now, I admit with some of those shows, if you're into The Voice and those things, they'll get ratings because you do want to see it as soon as possible. But you always tape it, you DVR it. Appointment viewing is sports. The last thing you want to do, I don't want to watch that game back. I'm not scouting that team. I got to watch it when it happens because you want to cheer, you want to root, and you want to see if you can strategize. Find it just fascinating. That's why Fox is going out and buying a whole bunch of properties. They obviously got baseball. They got horse racing now. They got a huge contract with football, and they got soccer. They got soccer going the UEFA Cup. They got soccer going with Copa America Cup. They got the World Cup. And what they do is, for those people that watch Fox Sports, you got to find them because it's appointment viewing.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. We're watching everything with the Hunter trial. The prosecution has rested. We got that. We also have excerpts from the president's speech at Ponta Hawk, where the special operators, special forces, went up the cliffs in order to try to disable the front lines of the Nazis who were trying to kill everybody as they landed on 5 separate beaches on D-Day. They're commemorating 80 years, as you know. So we'll have those two things developing. And right now we have Batya Unger-Sargon with us from Newsweek. Batya, great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
First off, did you have a chance to hear the president's speech at all?
I heard some of it this morning, yes. Did you?
While I'm doing the show, I'm in and out listening to some of it. Here's a little of his remarks.
Dawn, 6th of June, 1944. The wind was pounding as it is today and always has against these cliffs. 225 American Rangers arrived by ship, jumped into the waves and stormed the beach. They could see, all they could see was the outline of the shore and the enormity of these cliffs. And I'd like to look, I know I'll get in trouble with the Secret Service if I go to the edge and look over, but think of those cliffs as my hostess showed me.
Right. Thanks. Thanks for that. Appreciate the ad lib there. Not really strong. So his goal was to be Reagan. Did he effectively channel Reagan?
I don't think he did, but it's very interesting that he's now aiming for that kind of persuadable middle, because I think you see Trump doing that from the other side. If you remember this speech Trump gave in the Bronx, he was really talking about unifying the country and how success unifies people and how more unites us as Americans than divides us. And I think if there wasn't all this crap being thrown at him from all sides, that's the Donald Trump we would see a lot of, a unity candidate, a consensus candidate. And so Biden trying to do that in this symbolic way, not with any policy, right? The policy is all super far left, super unpopular. It just speaks to how desperate they're feeling, I think.
So, you know, we're going to talk about Gaza in a moment. And the fact is he didn't mention Israel in yesterday's speech. Were you shocked by that? It seemed like the perfect opportunity. You talked about a democracy in the Middle East.
I'm so glad you brought that up yesterday, because I was watching you. And when you said that, I thought that's exactly right. I'd been thinking that as well. We really have an assault on democracy happening in the Middle East. There's one country that's standing as a bulwark against our, the United States' enemies, and fighting for our, the United States' values in the region. And he didn't mention it at all. And it's so amazing to bring up the Nazis and the threat that they posed, you know, to all of our values and not mention the Jewish state literally fending off an attack from people who want both for there to be no Jewish state and for there to be no America. It was a great point, Brian.
So you're talking about in the Five last night, I just brought that up because Steven Spielberg was sitting in the front row. He's the writer director of Schindler's List, not just Band of Brothers. So use both. But why did he do it? Because he feels as though to bring up Israel would be unpopular. And he feels as though Netanyahu has been a thorn in his side because he doesn't listen. Well, maybe in my view, if you let him go out and win, let the IDF fight, as bad as it might be initially, it would have been over by now. Instead, we're watching a situation where we're trying to surgically go through an area that is intentionally filled with civilians while Hamas hides behind them. For example, this bus that was just bombed, there were 30 members of Hamas just there. So you can't prevent another attack and not wipe out Hamas. Why can't the president just admit that?
He's making the same mistake in terms of foreign policy that he is making in terms of domestic policy. And what I mean by that is he is convinced that the vast majority of Democratic voters support the Palestinians and Hamas over Israel because the loudest voices on Twitter and on TikTok do. And he has misunderstood fundamentally the American electorate. The vast majority of Americans, 80% of Americans, back Israel. And yet because the president is ensconced in this milieu and full of advisors who hate the average American and hate the working
class. State Department generally.
State Department, exactly. These people who believe that their credentials should give them the right to rule and tell everybody else what to think. They cannot see how popular Israel is among the average Americans. And, you know, Brian, I think that they're making a similar mistake in terms of the foreign policy when you look at a place like Ukraine. Ukraine, honestly, I know you're not, you know, you support Ukraine very much, but the American electorate is divided on this. There is a lot of frustration that we're given billions and billions of dollars to this other country when we have so many problems here at home. But because the president only has domestic policy, he thinks that Ukraine is totally a consensus issue because he can use it to attack President Trump.
And here's how he did it. At the time when you're sitting with Zelensky, when you're trying to say, we support you, you got $65 billion, I'm going to give you $273 million more. Instead, he says this, cut 20.
I'm not going to walk away from you. I apologize for the those weeks of not knowing what's going to happen in terms of funding, because we had trouble getting the bill that we had to pass that had the money in it from some of our very conservative members who were holding it up.
I can't even listen to it, but basically, instead of saying, we got the $65 billion, I want to get it there quicker, I thought at first when I saw the headlines of this soundbite that I'm like, all right, good. I'm glad he said it. But then when I watched, listened to this morning, I'm hearing that he's blaming Republicans. Listen, whatever happens, the world doesn't need to know that. You're the running the whole country. Don't say you can't get your... It makes you look weak that it took you forever to get this passed.
But it also reveals why he is so supportive of Ukraine. It has nothing to do with Ukraine and Zelensky. It is merely a cudgel he can use to attack the MAGA camp. Just like him flip-flopping on Israel and abandoning Israel in its time of need has nothing to do with Israel. It's just him pandering to young voters, to Muslim Americans, and then to George Clooney, apparently, who's running the State Department, it turns out.
And by the way, there's going to be a huge protest in Washington this weekend. They're training more protesters. You know, there's trainers flying around training young people to protest against Israel. There's going to be a huge protest in Washington this weekend. So that's something that they're going to be seeing. The president will probably miss it because he'll be in travel, go right to Delaware. But I think he has another stop when he's in France. But overall, the Russians have lost hundreds of thousands of people, 350,000, some say 400,000 people. They're losing, according to June 5th's remarks from Vladimir Putin, he's losing 20,000 guys a week. Can you imagine this? That's more than basically we've left in two wars over 20 years. That he doesn't even care about his guys, but they have more guys to throw.
Yeah, it's really horrible when you think about, you know, 500,000 young men just cut down, what that does to a society, what it does to a culture, what it does to women, what it does to the structure of the family. I really believe, I'm curious if you think so, but I really do believe that Trump would be able to create some kind of pathway to end this pretty quickly. Do you think so?
Well, number one, I think he should take Zelensky up on his invitation to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm not going to comment. He's playing it pretty well. He's good. Mm-hmm. He's a good politician. He's playing pretty well. He goes, I encourage the President of the United States, former President of the United States, to come visit. He'll see what we see.
Mm-hmm.
He'll see what Douglas Murray sees. He sees what General Kellogg saw. When he sends his people over, they understand what they're up against. And understand, too, China, Iran, Russia, they've formed in this line, North Korea, they've formed this alliance. And they're saying, okay, how long do we have to wait? First, whatever, if we invade another country like South Korea, Taiwan, there'll be initial uproar, there'll be sanctions, and then we'll wear them out. And that's the lesson Russia's going to take for this. Yeah, it was tough in the beginning, but now I've changed the focus on my economy. I deal with countries that are not really having these sanctions in force. I'm selling my oil to China. I'm selling my oil to India. I am selling my oil to, or letting Iran sell their oil. I'm not standing in their way at the UN. This is really working. But there's been no pressure from the president and his relationship to crack down on a place like India. What kind of leverage can we use with China? We don't know. But we're not doing it. But if they want Taiwan, they are studying to this. They're going to school on this.
Yeah, and the worst part about it is it's not just that he's not tough on China. It's that he's nothing. It's not just that he's not tough on Iran. He also didn't rejoin the Iran deal, which I would have been against. But he has no foreign policy, right? There's no use that he makes of any of these relationships. He gave Qatar, of all places, the status of a major non-NATO ally in 2021. Why? Nobody knows. What has he used that for? Has he used that to try to get American hostages out of Gaza? No, he has used it to do nothing. He has no foreign policy to speak of. He only has domestic concerns.
So how do you feel about the prime minister of Israel, Netanyahu, being invited here? We got a date in July.
I think it's great. I think there should be a real conversation there. I think, you know, it's great for him to come here to speak to the American people, to make the case for the war. And I think it's totally fine behind closed doors for American members of Congress and the Senate to talk to him, to convey their feelings, and for that to be a conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
Here is President Biden on that invitation and what the message he wants to get with his fraying support for Israel he claims at home. Cut 32.
On this relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, you have said repeatedly that Israel has every right to defend itself, yes, that America stands with Israel. But you also have at times said the response has been over the top, were your words. You warned about Rafah. We've seen what's happened inside Rafah. You're aware the weapons experts looked at the bomb that was used, some of the weapons that were used that killed civilians at that camp, and determined some of those weapons were American-made. Is Benjamin Netanyahu listening to you?
I think he's listening to me. They were going to go into Russia, into Rafah, full bore, invade all of Rafah, go into the city, take it out, move with full force. They haven't done that. And what they've done is they've agreed to a significant agreement that if, in fact, Hamas accepts it. And look, it's being backed by Egypt, being backed by the Saudis, being backed by the almost the whole Arab world. We'll see. This is a very difficult time.
he's saying that he can go into Rafah and goes on to sign a ceasefire. Do you think that's a good move overall for peace?
I think that President Biden is making the United States irrelevant to the Middle East just by flip-flopping and having no clear leadership, no backing of our ally in its time of need. It is simply pushing Israel into other arms, and there are other arms. The Saudis are eager to join the Abraham Accords. You have the UAE, you have Bahrain, you have Jordan shooting down Iranian drones to protect Israeli lives. Israel's going to be fine. You know, the Jewish people are going to be fine. Whether or not the United States has an active role in the Middle East in pursuing our interests, that is the thing that remains to be seen.
See, I don't know if they're going to be fine because I see Europe getting indifferent about the whole thing. We do supply the bulk of the arms. Unless they bring up their own military base, Hezbollah is only going to get stronger. And if Hamas survives, they'll get stronger. And Iran needs a check. For some reason, we don't want to sanction. We don't want to censure Iran. You know, with this administration, I worry about that because they got them in a vice, it seems.
I think Israel needs to be a little bit more independent. And the aid to Israel has been important, but Israel has paid a huge price in terms of it agreed, thanks to Obama, not to develop its own military industrial complex, which would have been a real competition for ours. And so I honestly think America got more out of the aid it has given to Israel than Israel did. And at some point, Israel, which is, you know, a wealthy country, it would be better for Israel to have a little bit more sovereignty because it would then stop having to listen to people like Joe Biden who don't have its best interests at heart.
So I did not know Obama got them not to develop their own weaponry?
Part of the memorandum of understanding signed right before Obama went out the door, Israel agreed that none of the aid that it gets from America can be spent in its domestic military industrial complex. And that was added at the last minute. Yeah.
So that's something that needs to be reversed. Now, Trump's going to come in. Evidently, he's got a problem with Benjamin Netanyahu now. I think it could be ameliorated. But one thing that he says is right. Get it over with.
Get it done.
Just think, get it done. Because they're losing. He understands the world community is easy to take the other side. But what also bothers me is President Biden's like, I'm close to getting a deal with Saudi Arabia. Really? Who set you up for that deal with Saudi Arabia? That was on the doorstep because of the Abraham Accords with Bahrain and the others. And Egypt, of course, was done already. And Jordan was done. That was on the doorstep to be knocked down, to be executed until October 7th happened.
And
he
you
never
remember,
mentioned the Abraham Accords either.
That's exactly right. For 2 years, they wouldn't even say the words the Abraham Accords. All they would do is talk about human rights abuses by who? The Saudis,
yes.
Right? You remember the first 2 years of the administration?
Pariah
Khashoggi
nation.
This, Khashoggi that, pariah nation. Suddenly they're doing a reversal. You think the Saudis want to deal with them? They don't. They're waiting anxiously for Donald Trump to come back.
And the Houthi rebels evidently dropped this huge bomb on them, but we're unable to suppress them. That waterway is still basically closed, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
That's incredible.
Yep, that's
now
right.
You know how with the Saudis, okay, they don't have the most sophisticated military air force. I got it. But one of the reasons why they're having so much trouble is the same reason it's hard to suppress a bunch of tribesmen hiding in caves. So they're still able to be an effective force despite all the bombings, which makes them stronger. But evidently they're hated in the region, the Houthi rebels.
Yes, absolutely. And meanwhile, I get the feeling that the Biden administration is actually trying to cut Israel out of the Saudi normalization deal, which is an atrocious
How could that
idea.
Be? That the whole point of normalization is right. Recognizing Israel.
Exactly. And they're trying to weaken Israel and strengthen all of our enemies.
Which we're going to sign a mutual defense act with Saudi Arabia. I'm for a creative deal, but I don't know. Do the American people want to go to war if the Saudis are attacked?
Right.
Right. Are they basically like NATO? I mean, we're sitting there for the longest time saying, what's with their government? That's where bin Laden came from. I see the reforms. I'm encouraged. But I don't know if I want to defend them like I would England.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point.
So we'll see what we sign off on. Bhatia, thanks so much. When can we read your next column?
Hopefully very soon. Hopefully next week or the week after.
All right, good. Take your time. No rush. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Don't forget to watch One Nation Saturday at 9 o'clock Eastern time. I know you're in different in time codes, but amongst my guests, we're going to have Pete Hegseth, of course. We're going to have Charles Payne. but most of all, a two-part interview with Dana White. And I think you'll love it. You talk about his friendship with Donald Trump, why he's accepted and lauded so much by the UFC crowd, and how he became the most expensive, sought-after, most successful sports franchise in the world. It's really a global game, the fight game now. Michael Richards, you know, he had that rant, that racist rant at a comedy club. Then he went under hiding. Well, he's starting to come back now, and he wrote a book. He was on with Jesse last night, and here he's talking about why and if he watches Seinfeld.
I never watched the shows because I could always see how they could be better, and I had to move fast each week in making each episode. It wasn't until really in the preparation of this book and getting tuned into the episodes, the seasons, 9 years of it, I watched every single episode in order of them being made as they were aired each week. And I had greater objectivity, and I remembered so much. And I just sat back and just laughed with my son at this amazing show that so many people came together and made it. The chemistry and the outcome was just sensational.
We got to get him on. I mean, I know he made a huge mistake. That rant that he had is out of control. I really don't know what's behind it. I don't know him. But the one thing I appreciate is Jerry Seinfeld got to know him extremely well, very loyal to him. He did him with Comedians with Cars having coffee. Besides that, he tried a few comebacks that didn't work. Do you think this will work?
I think hopefully if he keeps on saying yes to interviews and comes off as, you know, the guy who you just heard, I think it will.
Did he explain himself and what went into that rant? I missed the interview last night.
I missed it too. I didn't see it. I can't imagine that if he did, we wouldn't be hearing about it today.
Right. I mean, he's got to have written about it. So we'll see. But he's really talented. Told this story about never knowing who his dad was and got so mad at his mom for not telling him. And then later he found out. And that story's in the book. And now he feels terrible that he gave his mom such a hard time about it. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Starting June 10th, the Fox True Crime Podcast presents The Crimes of O.J. Simpson, 30 years later.
There are so many tentacles to this story. It's truly hard to put it all into a nutshell.
Emily Campagno takes you inside the crime scene and inside the courtroom, bringing you an inside look into the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman.
If this trial occurred today, there would not be an acquittal. Available on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.